From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the December edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. It's been quite a year here at the home of the Codebreakers, and things are showing no signs of slowing down anytime soon. Project Neptune, the long-awaited restoration of Bletchley Park, is now nearing the end of the beginning, if not the beginning of the end. Coming up, we discover hidden treasures under the mansion car park. We've got an exclusive interview with two heavyweight academics who spoke about some of the lesser-known heroes of Bletchley Park at a day of sold-out talks, Codebreakers Legacy. We bring you one Bomren's recollections, including blind dates, doodlebugs and the job with tweezers she describes as hell on earth. Before all that, though, here's what happened when a 10-centimetre cubed satellite weighing less than a kilogram was launched over Russia. This was recorded at the monitoring station in the National Radio Centre here at Bletchley Park.
Marta, would you do the countdown, please?
10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Whee!
Yes.
330 second from Arthur. Control status okay.
Yep.
Separation has been confirmed. We are in space.
Space!
Space! Space!
Yes!
Yes!
We have data!
We have data!
21 milliwatts power out, 21 degrees on the PA device, all data valid. We're getting 409 million.
Thank you! Yes.
Bus voltage is fine.
Battery voltage?
Battery voltage 7. Is 7.8. Total system current 123 milliamps. And the battery is 13 degrees. Yes!
I love that.
Could
be better.
I need to change that double.
Can you explain to me what happened there?
Okay, after the launch, we have a period of time to wait for the antennas to deploy, the aerials to deploy from the spacecraft. And by that time, the spacecraft is over the Indian Ocean. We were very lucky to have arrangements with a South African radio amateur who said he would listen for our signals. So we had got on the display the signals that we'd recorded at the last test before it was sent to Russia. And I was just looking at the screen and looking at the numbers and realising that the time was current and the numbers were changing. So it was coming in from South Africa. That data was live data that was coming from space down to South Africa and then via the internet to us.
So that's the moment you were after.
Yeah. And better than that, the numbers that were coming down, this data that we are going to be using for educational outreach for schools, all look pretty good numbers. The temperatures are right, the voltages are going up. And I'm looking now at the screen over there and they're all green, which is good to see.
So the data you're receiving is all about the status and performance of the CubeSat.
That's correct, yes. And it will show information about solar radiation, so schools can use it for talking about solar radiation, talking about orbits, why is the satellite rotating, different effects of different colours of materials, which is part of the curriculum at schools anyway. And temperatures, why something is hot and why something is cold. If it's facing the sun, obviously it gets hot. But how cold does it get when it's facing space? There's a whole raft of information there that can be used within education, not only in science subjects, but where is the spacecraft? Why can't we not hear it now? And we can 5 minutes later hear which countries is it flying over, geography, everything.
Brilliant. So to explain how big a deal this event is for you today, can you tell me how this began and how long you've been working on it?
AMSAT UK, a group of radio amateurs who have a particular passion for and interest in outer space. And right back in 1961, just 4 years after Sputnik was launched, OSCAR-1, orbiting satellite carrying amateur radio, was launched. So the first amateur satellite was launched really very early in the space game. There have been more than 70 amateur satellites previously launched. AMSAT here in the UK have never built their own spacecraft. This is our first ever spacecraft that we have built. It's very small. You can see the model there hanging from the ceiling. It's only a 10-centimetre cube. It weighs, has a mass of less than a kilogram, 982 grams precisely. So it's very small, but it's intended for educational outreach. It's all volunteer effort. It's all volunteer money or gifts via the charities and bequests from some estates. So it's been done entirely by volunteers, and it's been done in collaboration with our Dutch colleagues, AMSAT NL, and between us we've designed it, built it, paid for it, and paid for the launch. And it's taken us 4 years. Largely, not because it's taken us 4 years, but getting the launch has been really very difficult to get a launch for the right price. We've had to wait a long time.
So what drives you to be involved with this? It obviously takes a lot of dedication and energy, and you're obviously very passionate. So what is it that appeals to you about this?
I convinced myself that when I was 9 years old, I could hear signals from Sputnik 1 on the family radiogram. You might not know what a radiogram is, but it was a radio. It was a big piece of furniture you had in your sitting room that had a record player and a radio and a big loudspeaker and whatever.
I had one in my bedroom. Kept all my teenage concert tickets in the storage section.
Anyway, there's obviously no way that I actually heard a signal, but I convinced myself I heard a signal from the spacecraft. So that's what that
you
gave me the
kick. Fascinated by it, even as a child.
I must have been. Yeah, I was nine, I think. And then radio amateurs, you know, we've been involved with launching spacecraft, getting big spacecraft, small spacecraft launched. Why do we do it? Because we have a passion for it. And we have a particular passion these days. We became interested in STEM, science, technology, engineering and mathematics subjects. Everybody in that room, I think, has got that sort of passion. And we need to get the next generation to share that passion, because otherwise we won't have enough engineers to make all the beautiful kit that you're using to record and we're using to display.
Do you think there's a real shortage of interest in younger generation then?
I think there
subjects?
Has been. I see everything going in cycles. And I think we're coming out of that now. So I think the graph is now going up. The government, God bless them, are doing lots of good stuff to encourage science education and engineering. The word engineer is being promoted upwards. And it's going in the right direction. But we need to bring in the really young generation, primary school and secondary school children as well.
And Bletchley Park's the ideal place for you to hold this because of the importance of scientific thinking, mathematical thinking and engineering. So the success here during the war.
Yeah, this is a fantastic facility. We're really lucky that the Radio Society of Great Britain decided some years ago to establish this National Radio Centre here at Bletchley Park. And the location of it within Bletchley Park, I think, is going to be really, when you've finished all the renovations next door, it'll be next to perfect. So hopefully we'll be able to use this facility when your visitors come round to show them. Unfortunately, it's not there all the time. It's every hour and a half. But in the morning, we should be able to use the spacecraft to help show interesting stuff to your visitors.
How long is this going to be in space, and where's it going to end
up? It will be in space for something like 25 years. It will deorbit. It will gradually get lower and lower and deorbit.
I assume you mean long term. Fantastic.
Our longest living amateur spacecraft is Oscar 7, so that tells you how long ago, and that has just had its 39th birthday. Now, that one only works in the sunlight because the batteries are no longer present.
I know how it feels. Yeah.
There are lots of things that can go wrong. Obviously, there are thousands of solder joints on our spacecraft. Any one of those with thermal cycling can break. So I can't give any guarantees. But it is designed, like Oscar 7, to work in the sunshine. So the failure mode is often the batteries. So if the batteries fail, then we will still have a spacecraft that will work in the sun, and it will be an educational outreach satellite in the morning.
Oh, I hope it continues to go as well as it has so far.
Thank you.
And thanks for having us.
Okay.
Can you transmit blind and try and command the education mode?
Educational mode?
Yeah. Agreed, everybody?
Yeah. Auto flash, set for educational mode.
Fixed.
Going.
Can we see the commands on the warehouse?
Can you see the currents changing? Okay.
Send once.
Yeah, change from the concealed send again, keep sending.
Oh, she's up! Oh, yes.
First command! First command!
Graham, your frequency in your book.
My name's Howard Long, and I was tasked during the setup of the Funcube satellite of designing the ground segment. And what the ground segment is, it's what people on Earth can use to receive the FunCube satellite. So with that, I set to for several months, scratching my head, how can we do this at a reasonable cost and make it accessible for as many people as possible? And in the end, I came up with a design which uses some parts which are commonly found in set-top boxes that you might have on your TV to receive cable and satellite television. And because they're made in such large volumes, it's meant that we've managed to keep the cost of the ground segment at a reasonable price. So what we didn't know was how big the market was going to be for this. So originally, we were looking at perhaps doing 100 units, and that was really going to be it. But we used some quite new technology called software-defined radio. And with that, we managed to keep the cost down as well by actually making part of the receiver written in software on a computer. So I set to and put it together and did a few demonstrations of it in various forms to a final product, which is a nice little USB dongle-sized package. And what I hadn't realised or anticipated was how interested people were with the unit, because not only could it receive the FunCube satellite, it could also receive a vast part of the radio spectrum. So when I first put them up for sale back in 2010, I had 35 units that I've managed to make myself, and they sold out in under a minute. So I thought we're probably onto something here. So since then, we've sold over 12,000 units, and I have a waiting list of about 550 right now, which I'm trying to fulfil, and the manufacturer and me can't make them fast enough. So hopefully we will be in a stock position very soon, but it's been far more successful, and also it's meant that it's introduced a lot of people to amateur satellites and amateur radio in general, so we're quite proud of that. So the website is www.funcubedongle.com. And of course you can purchase it from there. You can also purchase them from specialist amateur radio retailers that are available from across the world. And another thing I'm quite proud of is actually that 95% of all the units actually are exported outside of the UK. Over half go outside the European Union as well. So it's been quite a success story from a commerce perspective as well. Again, we're quite proud of that.
The restoration of Bletchley Park has revealed the footings of buildings believed to be World War II huts. The car park next to the iconic mansion has been dug up, ready to be grassed over, as part of the £8 million Heritage Lottery-funded Project Neptune. The foundations had lain undisturbed under the tarmac for decades. We took a closer look with some history students from Milton Keynes College and Joel Greenberg, Bletchley Park historian.
So we need to clean all this up. Areas such as this, where we're pretty sure there should be a wall under it, but is there or has it been destroyed? So scrape it back to see if you can find anything under here. And continue along. Here again, we've got lots of bricks which are underneath. So what we want to see is a very clear line distinguishing. If you come across anything, you know, like bits of wood and things we found, if you uncover something like it, stop, record, photograph, keep going. Okay, are you happy with that?
Yeah.
Brilliant.
So, like,
so what I'd like to see by the end, hopefully, is a nice clean line of this all the way along, if it exists.
Okay.
Okay, cool.
Should we do it in like three different sectors?
Yeah, start a different set. Take a section each. Mm. I mean, you can see on your plan roughly how far the building's meant to go, but I'd love to be able to find where it ends, so the corner coming round.
Just down. Fallen down, isn't it? Yeah.
The piece of wall that comes down.
Yeah, that must be one of the bits from somewhere else, isn't it?
So you've brought the AS level history students round.
That's right.
Round the corner, all the way from Milton Keynes College, to have a look at what we've found. How exciting did they find this when you mentioned it?
They were really excited. I sort of asked the group who enjoys history, and all the hands went up, and then who fancies going on a dig, and everybody was really excited about the idea. And unfortunately, we've got a second trip out today, so we've got a slightly smaller group than we might have had, but the whole class would have come had it not clashed, and we've actually got, you know, a dozen or so of the students here.
And what sort of thing have they been doing?
Well, they started off measuring up the walls and a couple of artefacts that had been found, or you know, pieces of building material and so forth. So they've been measuring up, taking notes. They're now helping to expose some of the foundations and footings of the walls from the huts. So they're sort of digging away with trowels and scraping things to clear them and have a look at what's there.
How good an opportunity is this for you as a history teacher to bring them something that's just been found?
Fantastic. It's really, you know, brought a bit of history to life for them, shown them something that they, you know, that they could get involved with it, either as volunteers in their spare time now, as being people who are interested in history, and also something that they'd get involved with if they were studying history at a higher level. You know, it just sort of brings things to life a bit in a different way than we can in the classroom.
It's not that sort of dry, this was discovered years ago, we know all about it, you must learn dates and names, and it's very different from that, isn't it?
Absolutely, yeah. It's, you know, it's, as I say, it's physically doing something that really links them to the past.
Credit to them, they're out here in the cold and the damp and they're knee deep in mud, and they all look still quite enthusiastic about it.
They are, they're going really well, aren't they?
Yeah. See how they're getting on.
It's been really good. It's interesting.
Trying to find. Cover some foundations, it looks like.
You're digging quite a long way down.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder how far these things go down.
What do you make of it, given that you live around here? Do you feel proud of this on your doorstep? Is it strange to think there's this big national concern here?
It is definitely important, and it's great that it's so close, because it is something to brag about, because one of the most important inventions invented here in modern times, so I am very proud to have it very close to where we live.
Thank you, Ian.
No worries.
I just found a step right here, and it's a different foundation as well, so we're trying to work out whether this is a door, and there was different bricks here, so there's modern stuff as well.
How exciting is it to have this on your doorstep?
It's quite exciting, actually. My parents got married here as well, so I know a lot about Ritchie Park, so it's quite good, actually.
Did you know about the huts hidden under the car park?
No, I didn't. So always good to find something new, I suppose.
I actually thought it was wood up there, not
quartz.
Well, it's
the same sort of material, isn't it?
Just a weird shape. It would be a doorstopper type thing.
To be fair, anything's possible. If we find more, then we'll get a clearer picture. I'll go and have a look, see if there's anything over there. Keep an eye out if there's anything else similar in the area. Because if we find a cluster in an area, that will, well, it will tell us that it's not just an odd job or door wedge. If you find a cluster or something, it tells us maybe they were put together to create something, or a bit of flooring or something like that. So see what else you can find.
From this English heritage photograph, which was photographed by an airplane around 1946, by blowing it up, we can see exactly the footings of the huts that we're looking at, Hut 2, the one nearest to the mansion, and then we can see Hut 9, which was obviously Hut 3 in the early days. By taking a line with the bungalow, we can see exactly where it is and be absolutely certain of its location.
Oh, yeah, that's what survived.
Of course, there was in Hut 9A, of which there doesn't seem to be anything, just to the right. There was also a little naffy hut in front of Hut 9, just over there.
You say Hut 9 was an early iteration of Hut 3?
Yeah, it was originally Hut 3. It was used for a military section. And then when they built, as they started to expand and the Hut 3, Hut 6 model was put into place, they built Hut 3 over here. They took the name with them.
So then this became
renamed
Hut 9.
Hut 3 became Hut 9. Right. That was normal here. When the people from Hut 6 moved into Block D, Hut 6 was numbered 16. When the people from Hut 8 moved into Block D, they became 18. 3 became 23. Couldn't be 13, I guess.
It's no wonder people get confused.
Yeah.
About continuing what was going on where?
Well, it's the fact that they kept the hut numbers as the departmental names.
Rather than the real estate.
Yeah. You know, if you work for the finance department of a large company and you move into another building, it's still called the finance department.
Yeah. So how exciting for you as a historian is it to see these pop up out of the ground?
The reason I find it exciting is that we've never had the chance to investigate, as far as I'm aware, the footings before. The wooden huts that were destroyed or dug up. As far as I'm aware, there was no real investigation of the footings. These were two of the original huts. The wooden huts went a long time ago, but the fact that the footings survived, probably because they were under a foot of tarmac. It's the first chance, from an archaeological point of view, we've been able to investigate, and perhaps it'll tell us something about why these wooden huts managed to survive so long.
I hear, and I'm not sure how accurate this is, that we've established that six, at least, was built elsewhere, brought here and reassembled on the footings. Mm-hmm. So maybe these were done in that way too.
Perhaps. That I'm not certain, but a lot of the huts were built on site. It isn't clear how they actually did them, other than they threw them up very, very quickly.
Well, it gives you a glimpse into that urgency, doesn't it?
Yeah, but they were, in effect, garden sheds. Plunked down on brick footings with a bit of concrete thrown in. Well, it's always assumed it was brick, but investigating this will allow us, because as I look over here, I can see concrete as well as brick, so it might tell us even more.
Yeah. And hut two was mainly for catering, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a recreation hut. You buy cigarettes, get beer, and lunch vouchers, I believe.
I hear they served cake, but only on Thursdays.
Yeah, there was also a lending library as well. So that was always its function, but the function of hut three, then hut nine, changed. As hut nine, it was really the main administration building. Faulkner and then a guy called Captain Bradshaw, who were the people responsible for the building program. They had offices there, pay slips, and people went to get paid. Actually, where we're standing right here.
Was 9A an extension of that?
Yeah, it's also from the era of photographs. There was a tiny little building just back of, over in that corner over there. 2A, it's known as, but it's unclear what its function is.
Maybe lost to history, or we may find out.
Great, so. Unless somebody documented things at the time, it's very, very difficult. Because, for example, we have things like the official history of Hut 6, three volumes in the National Archives. But that was written at the end of the war, in late 1945. So even some of that, the people who are writing it, were writing about things that may have happened 5 years earlier. How good is their memory? As a historian, one has to be very careful in making definitive statements about what went on, unless you have a source document written exactly at the time something took place. An aerial photograph is pretty hard to argue with.
You know, the history of buildings would usually turn to plans and things, but of course this was urgent operational need, top secret as well, and that really throws that notion out the window, doesn't it?
Yes, and one suspects they were able to circumvent regulations. This was given the highest priority, had the endorsement of the Prime Minister, funding, etc. Although I did read recently that while Churchill had said, given everything they want, that hadn't gotten through to the Labour Minister of Works, and there were sometimes delays in getting the actual funding in here. But the building programme proceeded, and this whole site was a building site throughout the war. Yeah. Continually building these huge concrete buildings.
Yeah, as the need changed.
There is a video somewhere of Block F being knocked down around 86, 87 with these wrecking cranes bouncing off it because the footings were 6 foot square concrete with steel girders set in concrete footings. So these things were indestructible. They were built to withstand bomb blasts. And I guess we shouldn't be surprised. They were hard to knock down.
Yeah.
It's a shame it was. It was an amazing, amazing looking building.
Yeah.
It looked like a prison, but going through an arch up the roundabout. You cross the roundabout up to Block H.
Wonder what else we might find as we go along. Turing silver. People talk about dredging the lake looking for that, but I doubt he'd have chucked it in there.
No, apparently all they said was somewhere around Bletchley, according to Donald Mickey and Sean Wiley, who went with him to find it. Apparently he offered Mickey a percentage. They were negotiating if they found it. He offered him a percentage, but they never found it.
Codebreaker's Legacy was a sold-out day of talks by eminent experts, including Professors Jack Copeland and Barry Cooper. The two of them took time out to chew the fat about the never-waning interest in Alan Turing and how that draws people in to learn about other key codebreakers. They also let us in on what they think about the forthcoming film about Turing.
After the explosion of interest in Alan Turing's life and work during his centenary year last year, you might have expected this year to be a bit quieter. Well, it definitely hasn't been. I've got two Turing experts with me now.
Professor Turing hippies. Two 60s children.
Well, 50s, some of us.
Get away with you.
I've got Jack Copeland and Barry Cooper with me here. What do you think is going to happen in the next year? A pardon? A new film? I mean, do you think Turing's finally becoming a household name?
Yeah, I'd say Turing's becoming a household name. It's taken a long time, but it's happening.
Well, it would be great if it did happen. I must admit that there's lots of indications that Turing's not as well known still as he should be. A friend of mine, her daughter, was in a class where the kids were asked about Alan Turing, and she was the only person in the whole class. This was secondary school, the only person in the whole class who'd heard of Alan Turing. So it's still an uphill journey, I think, but with the movie and the possibility of a pardon next year, I think there'll be a lot of media interest in Turing.
But I mean, even 5 years ago, maybe, I don't think, would you have even had one person in that class who would have known who Turing was? I think we have come a long way, really, haven't we?
Yeah, one of the really nice things over the last couple of years is that school kids write to me and say, I'm doing my project on Turing. Can I email a few questions to you? Or can we talk on Skype? And I guess this has happened, more than half a dozen times now. So Turing is getting out into the schools, certainly not as much as he should. There's a long way to go yet. But it started. We're just seeing the beginnings of it now, and it will grow and grow.
I mean, the film definitely is going to make a big difference, isn't it? I mean, what do you think about the casting?
Well, I thought that people were being a little unfair to the filmmakers in the early days, and I think now people are beginning to realise that the filmmakers, their heart's in the right place anyway, even if they are under commercial pressure. And I think Benedict Cumberbatch is a great choice. He's the right sort of person. He's a great actor, and he's fairly well known around the world. And Keira Knightley, I don't share the criticisms that that people have made, although I haven't seen the way the plot works out. It'll be interesting. Fingers crossed it'll all be true to the history.
Yeah, I think Cumberbatch is, nearly perfect for the role. And there were so many scare stories about other American actors who are going to be taking the role, over the last few years. And I can remember feeling physically relieved when I heard that Cumberbatch was taking it on. I think it'll be a great thing for Turing. I'm looking forward to it.
I would just say, I think it's going to be nice for the kind of geekish kids, the kind of get bullied in school and so on, and there'll be some appreciation of the individuality and the kind of contribution and the kind of pure heroism of intellectual adventurers in the world nowadays.
Because we've spoken before that Turing, he's such a great figurehead for so many different types of people, isn't he? Yeah. In the gay community, the Asperger's community, exactly. The geeky community. Exactly. And, having someone that they can relate to, it's Sherlock Holmes from the TV, is actually this guy, in a way, is another in, really, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, you use the word Asperger's, and I think that's a kind of community that needs a little positive attention. I think kids at school can often have a terrible time, if they're a little bit geekish. Things get better as you get older. You go to university, you get in a field with people, similar kind of approach to life, and things get a lot better. And I think kids should realise that can happen. Of course, Turing's not a great example, in the sense that he was bullied in later life for being gay, and that's we still have to get over in some way.
So do we move on to another codebreaker next, or do we carry on fighting for Alan's name and making him more famous and making him that household name he should be?
I personally will be doing both. It's not an either or. I think there's a lot more to be written and said about Turing, but of course there are all these other fascinating figures like Bill Tutt and like Tommy Flowers, and I shall continue working on these characters as well.
Yeah, I'd like to see more attention to all sorts of scientists. I think science isn't properly valued in the UK as it should be, and I think other countries probably, that don't make such a great contribution to science, scientists are better valued.
Yes, and the sort of, theoretical science has, kind of more kudos than the practical end of it. It's sort of, there's this kind of hierarchy. There's the arts, and then there's, like physics and the theoretical stuff, and then there's engineering. And I think one of the really good things about Bletchley Park and the whole code-breaking story is that it brings out the importance of engineering and the fact that engineers make breakthroughs too. It isn't just theoretical physicists.
Yeah, I mean, Colossus couldn't have existed without Tommy Flowers, could it?
That's right. It was his idea. He built it.
Yeah, that's a good point. One of the great kind of outcomes of the Turing year is that we're getting all these fantastic books about history, about the science, about the code breaking, about Bletchley Park and so on. And I think Jack's book is great. It's got all sorts of good stuff in it. And I think my book, which was a labour of love that almost killed me off, is something everybody should have on their bookshelves, but if they can afford it.
Yeah, I think it's great. There's this whole wave, this torrent of new work on Turing coming out. And, you know, many, many books came out last year on Turing, all of them excellent. I'm proud to be part of it. And Barry's book is just tremendous. You know, the definitive collection on Turing.
Tickets are on sale now for the next two History and Archive courses at Bletchley Park in January and February. And Family Fun Wednesdays will make a welcome return in the school holidays throughout 2014. When veterans visit Bletchley Park, they tend to find the deeply buried memories come flooding back. They're not always memories of code-breaking work, though, as with Cynthia Legg, a Wren bomb operator posted to Eastcote and Stanmore. She visited with her two daughters, who'd mounted a long campaign to persuade her to come, because this place didn't hold very happy memories. But she was delighted she had, and told podcast producer Mark Cotton about a particularly memorable night out in London.
The bomb is basically 36 Enigma machine equivalents. Each set of three drums is equivalent to the three rotors of an Enigma machine. Now, you'll see they're colour-coded. Each drum is equivalent to one of the rotors on an Enigma machine. So the first thing the Wrens had to do was plug up 60 variants of this, because that's the number of variants of the rotors you could have. So the colour-coding told them which ones in which order. So as the month went on, though, thankfully the Germans never allowed the same sequence to be done. So as you got to the end of the month, you could guess what the three were going to be, because they never allowed the same thing to happen again. So round the back, we have a plug board, and we're going to plug it up with cables that are 26-way cables, because each wire carries a letter. The Wrens during the war, one of them would plug up the cables and put on the drums, and she would plug N, which is electrically available on there. She'd plug N to the input and plug E to the output. And she'd set it to Z, Z, B. So now it's looking just like that Enigma machine when it did that translation, all right? And basically you plug up all 12. So all 12 Enigmas are now ready to search for their pairs. So let me just run her.
I remember that, though. That clickety click, clickety click.
Is it bringing back lots of memories for you?
Yeah, yes, it's all right. I thought I could remember it all, but, you know, I'd forgotten that they were different speeds.
And there are also quite a lot of information that you weren't given, which you can probably be quite
interested yes,
to learn
but it was
now.
Too complicated for me. And we were just in charge of the machines.
So when did you join up?
43.
So it's quite late on. Did you
yes, I wasn't old enough.
You went straight on to Stanmore.
I was 18. No, I went to Eastcote for training, and then from Eastcote I went to Stanmore, which is a doddle.
And did you ever actually come to Bletchley?
Oh, yes, yes. 45, we were rushed here to break Japanese code.
Was that much different
from
what you'd been
totally,
doing before?
Totally different. To start with, two alphabets, and they were finding it very difficult. But we were on one of these funny machines where you put cards in and they go through the dots. I can't remember what they're called.
Punch card machines?
Yeah, something like
Freeborn.
That.
Freeborn?
They used to have it in offices afterwards. Mm. After.
And so when you worked on the bomb, that's quite all-consuming, isn't it? It's a lot of time that you're standing and waiting, but then the adrenaline kicks in. You've got to work really fast.
You've got to work really fast because you've got to get rid of a dozen drums of one colour and change it for another colour, and then I've forgotten a lot, but it's brought it a lot back.
The sound must be quite important.
It's the sound is definitely you'd never forget that sound.
It's quite all pervading, isn't it?
Mm.
It might sound like an odd question and it might sound really open ended, but what was it like? Because obviously we can only really imagine and try and recreate.
You mean buildings wise?
atmosphere and what your memories of it are?
Oh, well, I think it's great fun. Fabulous. I mean, I've been away at school and I couldn't wait because I was a wanderer. I liked to get out and about and everywhere. And my mother gave up. She knew I was going to join up. And I went into that. I didn't know what I was going to go into. But I you know, went into it with open eyes. Didn't know what I was doing. But once I got into it, they had watches. And I made several very good friends. We were about six of us in a sort of gang. And it was great. Because I was young enough to, you know, really enjoy it and kick the soil from under my feet and just had a good time.
Yes,
we worked very hard.
To throw yourself into it, didn't you? Played hard as well. Did you travel into London quite a lot?
Oh, yes, whenever we could. We went to various art clubs. We hadn't got much money, but we were allowed very cheap entrance into clubs and, you know, just general meeting clubs and one thing and another, nightclubs. It was great. The work was very, very definite, precise. And the tweezing the drums was just hell on earth.
Was it?
Have you seen them down?
I've seen it sort of recreated. I haven't seen it in earnest.
They're all little tiny copper wires. And there's 36, 12 times, whatever it is, all the way around, I can't remember. And you have to make sure that one wire from one group isn't touching another. Otherwise it fuses and it doesn't show up. It shorts.
Crikey, that's fiddly work, isn't it?
Fiddly. But then, you see, when you're young, you take it all in and you just get on with it because it's got to be done.
What about after the war? What did you do next?
Oh, I went to commercial college and did secretarial and ran in a small office for a long time. Went to France, worked there. I did all sorts of things.
And when you, in those 10 or so years after the war, look back on your time here, did you just sort of put it all behind you and move on the way that we
have? Oh, I moved on. Yeah. I always moved on.
Never given it much thought?
Not really. It was just a sort of time in my life where I met a lot of very interesting people, nice people, and we were all pretty well the same character. You know, we were all the same, more or less the same age, and we'd all just sort of left home and gone into it.
And what about your family? Did they ever press and want to know what you'd been doing?
No.
Accepted?
No, they accepted. They knew I was doing something security, and they were, you know, very security-minded themselves.
What did you think when you started to hear stories of it coming out in the 70s and it started to be revealed?
I never really heard of it because you're so attuned to secrecy. I was married for 23 years. My husband never knew what I did. And nobody else knew because nobody was interested. And it was just not spoken about. So you're so, it's sort of 20 years later, or whatever it was. You don't give it a thought. You've just been quiet so long that you've got other things to think about. When you're young, you move on, don't you? You don't sort of think
You don't
back.
Dwell on things.
No. It's gone. That's, even now I don't talk about it. Because it's so drummed into your, you know, not through your life, but just when you go in there, you do not speak. And you took it for granted, so you didn't speak.
Have your daughters and your grandchildren been fascinated to hear about it in more recent years?
Well, my two daughters have, yes. I don't really mention it to them.
But this is typical modesty, as I would say, because you did something very important, and we might not be here if you hadn't.
Well, I might not be here in 6 months. Or,
well, you know.
Because we're a dying breed, actually.
Yes, of course.
Because you've got to be a certain age to have been able to do it in any case.
Exactly. We now tend to meet people like yourself who actually only joined up towards the end of the war because you only became old enough.
Well, you've got to be in your ages.
Yeah.
I mean, I was, what, to say 18, and I'm, what, 18, 88, 89, so...
Well, I'm glad you could come and see the recreation we've got.
Absolutely fascinating.
Thank you very much.
And it's beautifully done.
Thank you.
And I've been dying to get into this bit. And the people showing us around and everything have been fantastic. They're fabulous.
Well, I'm delighted to hear you've enjoyed it.
Oh, I have enjoyed it.
It's an honour to have you here. Thank you.
Very much. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
There's the front. Do you remember?
I do remember. Yes. I'll never forget it.
No. Okay. And the piano wires...
Where are the tweezers?
We haven't got any,
I'm afraid.
Sorry.
We're not going
to
make you work.
Would you like
today?
To hold it?
Oh, my goodness.
Do you remember that?
I'll never forget that. Oh, gosh, right. Yes, it's memories. How many are there, actually?
So it's 108 brushes with 14 wires in each brush.
So it's 108?
Yeah, 108.
That's more than I thought. I know they all had to be tweezers.
Indeed, yes.
And you had to do it very quickly. I mean, there was no time to spare. You just went all the way around.
Yes.
You sat on the edge of the tables, so going quick.
Yes.
Yes.
Feel those. You'll feel familiar about.
Oh God, dear. Oh, I thought there was something missing. You know those flat ones we tried?
Yes.
And they used to go. Yes, I remember these very well. You went A, Z, and you had to reach up there. And they seemed to be never ending. Mm-hmm. It was worth it. It was hard work.
Yes. You enjoyed it.
But, oh yes. They were a whole gang, and we did have fun.
And where were you based?
My main base was Stanmore.
Stanmore.
I was in Stanmore for about 8 months, including D-Day. And we watched all the American planes go over. Right. And there were wave after wave of planes about 6 o'clock in the morning.
Fantastic.
We were on the night watch.
Right.
And it was just never stopped. You, just noise of planes.
Something never to forget.
It is incredible. That's one thing I do remember. Mm. Then we went home to bed.
Mm. The busiest day of the decoding war. D-Day. Yes. 18,000 messages, was it that day?
Oh, was it?
Yes.
Things like this, keeping these stories alive, the Wrens especially are great because, and the lady was here from Stanmore the other week, she said, we were all girls, and I won't have any of this that we weren't girls, because we were girls.
Oh, we were.
Because we were 17 years old.
Yes.
And you weren't a lady until you were 21.
Absolutely right. It was fun. It was great. We had the bombs in London, of course. But then, again, you're at a young age. You don't realise the importance of it, really. Well, you didn't then, because it was wartime.
You just lived for times that...
Yes, you just went off. We had the bus bombs. First one I ever saw, I was in Hyde Park with a blind date. Mm. Oh, God.
Well,
I didn't think he got away quite enough. Because I just leapt at him, this thing came over ahead. It was buzzing. And then it kicked out. And it fell. And there was an enormous explosion. We didn't even know anything about it until then. I mean, that was in London.
So that wouldn't have been long after that, D-Day, was it?
We had one on the camp, actually.
On Stanmore?
Mm. Well, it was on the edge of the perimeter.
No, we love our veterans because you're all just fantastic. You've all got brilliant stories. In a way, because you all were that young at that time, you were, you know, at the start of your lives, really, and you were like, no, we're just going to enjoy ourselves when we can enjoy
ourselves.
Oh, we
did.
Yeah, we'll work.
Oh, we did work really hard, yes, you're right.
But when we're not working, we have a laugh.
Yes. And it was a watch system, of course, which I didn't particularly like, but you got used to it. 8 to 4, 4 to 12, 12 to 8.
And you worked in pairs with your checker, didn't you? Did you have the same checker all the time?
More or less. I was working the machine, and she was through a little, you know, over a counter. I can't remember how we contacted her. I think she was over a counter.
At Stanmore, yes, because that's exactly what Norma said to me.
I think it's sort of like you threw in a cash thing, maybe. You wrote down on a piece of paper what your stock was, and then you posted it through. Mm.
That's how she described it. Mm. And then if it was your break, you could run off at that point, go and quickly grab your dinner, and come back, let the checker go off.
Yeah, yes.
Come back.
And that's it. Yes.
On to the next settings.
You did double work, and at midnight you went off. Four, there were three breaks. I think it was something until 3:30 to 4. I can't remember exactly. You had half an hour or 20 minutes.
Yeah. No, it's been absolutely wonderful to meet you.
It's been great coming here. My two daughters have been absolutely fabulous. They've given it me, well, they brought me here as a birthday surprise.
Oh, did they?
Yes.
Well, Mummy, you didn't want to visit here for a long time.
Oh,
we kept asking Mum. We've been asking for years, but she, oh, no, I'm not interested. And then I said to her 2 weeks ago, didn't I? I said, come on, Mum, let's go to Bletchley for the day. And I think you're really pleased now.
Oh, I'm absolutely delighted, I mean.
She didn't want to come. I don't think Mummy had very happy memories of Bletchley.
You love Stanmore, didn't you? But Bletchley, well, I didn't like Bletchley particularly. I didn't like Woburn Abbey. It was cold and I fell down the curly staircase, you know, and it was stone steps. And I ended up in the hospital.
So we should go there.
There were no fellas anywhere around. And the pub was about nearly a mile away. So we go down there and have a drink. We've got to get all the way back. Because no transport. I mean, you have to remember just blackouts. Oh, just finishing blackouts. But no names of any roads or anything like that. Coming here, saying to Vicky, because in the old days, you never had a name on a road or a lane or no signpost where you're going. You forget that.
Well, I think you've got two very proud daughters there.
I've got two fabulous daughters. They really look after me. They don't boss me about.
Oh, see, well, I don't know who bosses who more. I think you certainly put us in our place, well, keep us in check, I should think. That's a way of saying it.
It's been really enjoyable. I have enjoyed it.
Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast. For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @bparkpodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.